The National Transportation Safety Board concluded today that the engineer of Amtrak Train 188 was distracted by an incident involving a SEPTA train moments before the deadly derailment 1 year ago. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In its final report on the wreck that claimed 8 lives, investigators placed blame on the engineer, but also said safety technology could have prevented the accident, as WHYY's Bobby Allen explains.
As engineer Brandon Bastian headed toward Frankfort Junction, the reports over his radio of a disabled SEPTA train worried him. It had been pelted with rocks, shattering a windshield.
He was concerned that there might be workers on the tracks inspecting the SEPTA train, which was something he needed to look out for.
NTSB crash investigator Steve Jenner says Bastian accelerated for 40 seconds, hurtling into the bend at 106 miles per hour. Confused where he was, he thought he passed the curve where he was supposed to speed up. Board member Robert Sumwalt says that was a normal human error that proved to be tragic.
He went in a matter of seconds from distraction to disaster.
Investigators noted that it was nighttime and there weren't any slowdown or curve warning signs posted. Investigator Ted Turpin says that's actually totally normal. Engineers pride themselves on memorizing the routes without signs.
I think you could go out there right now in the cab of a locomotive and blindfold an engineer and then take him to a certain location and take the blindfold off, and you'd be shocked how quickly he would tell you exactly where he is.
Since the derailment, though, new signage has been posted. And along most of the Northeast Corridor, the automatic braking system, known as positive train control, is up and running, says investigator Tim DePape.
And in this instance, it would enforce the 50-mile-an-hour speed restriction.
The report highlighted other issues, including problems with emergency windows, which contributed to 4 deaths. The NTSB also recommended looking into adding passenger seatbelts and ways to better secure luggage. And most importantly to this incident, new training and procedures to help engineers keep track of where they are. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The city has denied its application for a permit, but a group of anti-poverty activists is vowing to march through Center City, Philadelphia, when the Democratic National Convention is in town. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports.
Longtime activist Sherry Honkola applied for the permit on behalf of her organization, the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. She says more than 500 people will march from Broad Street to FDR Park in South Philly on the first day of the convention, permit or no permit.
Poor and homeless people, the last thing that we have is our voice, and they're not going to take that away from us.
A city spokeswoman says Honkola's request was rejected because the march would conflict with another event in the area and would require police to shut down Broad Street during rush hour. Philadelphia officials have received 9 applications for demonstration permits during the DNC. So far, only one has been granted for a climate change march the day before the convention starts. Other applications are still being reviewed. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
Last week, the Obama administration released details of another round of targeted deportations. It's the second time this year that federal immigration agents stepped up efforts to detain and remove women and children from Central America who came to the U.S. after 2013. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that local immigrant communities wonder how many people will be sent back this time.
In January, Immigration and Customs Enforcement picked up 121 women and children around the country during a single 3-day wave. Peter Pedamonti, head of faith-based immigration advocacy group The New Sanctuary Movement, says the Philadelphia area wasn't especially affected.
We didn't see like a big sweep, what people might typically think of like a large raid in Philadelphia, but what we have seen is them still targeting Central American refugees and just going to their individual houses.
He says that's what families are expecting this time, too. Still, awareness of greater enforcement makes people fearful, says Estella Hernandez, a mother of 3 from Mexico in this country illegally. She says when the last round of raids happened,
mucha gente dejó de llevar a sus hijos a las escuelas.
Several families, they didn't take their children to school, and they, like, stopped living their life normally.
This time, she says, people are getting more used to the enforcement, but many still go into hiding during the surges. ICE doesn't talk about current operations, but spokeswoman Jen Elzey confirms that the recent uptick in removals is part of cracking down on certain groups that are marked as a priority, which includes criminals. She says the surges are targeted and, quote, ICE will continue to adhere to existing guidance to avoid the apprehension of individuals at sensitive locations such as schools, hospitals, and places of worship, end quote. Elzey would not confirm how long the stepped-up enforcement will last, but other news outlets have reported it will continue into June. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
New Jersey is in need of an infusion of dollars to ease public employee pension fund debt and fund transportation-related maintenance and improvements. Toward that end, some lawmakers are eyeing a potential windfall from cashing in on the state's four public television stations. Let's change the channel with John Reitmeier, NJ Spotlight budget and public finance writer. John, welcome back to NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's look at this asset as an aggregate. These stations are in a coveted broadcast market between Philadelphia and New York.
Yeah, that's right. New Jersey decided decades ago to purchase public television commercial licenses to be able to broadcast news to all of our residents who normally see a lot of Philadelphia and New York news. And so now we find ourselves in control of these assets that have been valued in the hundreds of millions for each station and over $2 billion when you add up the airwaves controlled by all four stations.
If the sale, though, is ultimately completed, would New Jersey residents be deprived of that programming?
Well, it doesn't look like most of them would be because as technology has changed, it seems to be more people are viewing the programming using cable or even satellite. And so the reliance on just the broadcast signal for programming seems to have waned over the years. That said, there are those, especially those who have ditched cable, who still do get programming over broadcast. And so it looks like they would be impacted.
So this cashing in would come in the form of auctioning off the state's broadcast frequencies. How would it work?
Yeah, and it's a really complicated process. The FCC is running this auction. It starts at the end of the month. New Jersey has decided to get into it, but the acting treasurer told lawmakers during budget committee hearings last week that there are no guarantees. It's going to play out in what's called a reverse auction format. So unlike a normal auction where the buyers compete against each other to purchase an asset until someone, the last person standing, is willing to pay the highest price. The reverse format, the sellers are actually competing against each other, so the bid prices are likely to drop as each round goes forward. New Jersey's law also prevents it from selling the airwaves controlled by all four stations. So no matter what, the state wouldn't divest itself of all of the airwaves. That said, as you said, it is a very valuable market. So there's expectations that we're going to cash in at least some money here.
How was that determination made to conduct this as a reverse auction?
That's a decision that was made by the Federal Communications Commission. And I should step back. This auction is playing out because the demand in the consumer market is now picking up on the side of wireless providers, streaming video, content that you can view on a smartphone. As consumers move away from traditional television programming, and so a lot of the television stations control large swaths of bandwidth that now the federal government is eyeing up for wireless providers to meet their demand.
Is there some point at which New Jersey will have the right to value the price and say, yes, let's go through with the sale, or no, let's hold out for a higher bidder?
Well, that's a really good question. So in the reverse auction format, and again, last week lawmakers were told that, you know, the state might decide to just take a pass, and if the price isn't right, might walk away. And there are some who believe that going forward, it might make sense to wait this out, that as technology continues to change, these assets might become even more valuable and that the state might have even more to gain by selling at a later date. So a lot of balls still up in the air and a lot still to learn on this one.
John Reitmeier, NJ Spotlight budget and public finance writer. Still ahead, despite encroachments by big development projects like the Vine Street Expressway and the Convention Center, Philadelphia's Chinatown has maintained a sense of history and community for over a century.
Even if people aren't settling directly in Chinatown, Chinatown is still the heart, the cultural heart and the symbolic heart of the community.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. A 25-year-old technology consultant from Voorhees, New Jersey, is hoping to become the youngest person elected to Congress in decades. He's taking on a powerful Democrat with a last name familiar to many South Jerseyans, Donald Norcross. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has the story of a bitter primary battle shaping up in New Jersey's 1st District.
Donald Norcross is an electrician by trade, something he says the more than 200 lawyers in Congress haven't let him forget since he was sworn in 2014.
You know, they laugh about it and they'll call me over and say, hey, I got this electrical problem, can you help me out? It's all in good fun.
Norcross says his blue-collar background has led him to pursue policies that encourage job creation and support workers. He recently sponsored a bill to hike the federal minimum wage to $15 over 7 years.
As I've said so many times, the best social program is a good job, to give somebody the dignity of taking a paycheck home.
Norcross's challenger in the 1st District, which includes Camden County and parts of Gloucester and Burlington counties, is Alex Law. The 25-year-old NYU grad who's never run for public office says Norcross cares more about special interests than he does about his constituents in South Jersey. In this online video, he accuses Donald Norcross and his brother George, widely seen as one of the most powerful Democrats in the state, of running a South Jersey political machine.
It is a machine made up of the worst kind of politicians, one loyal to machine first and constituent second. It is a machine with parts oiled by money plundered from the state and our hometowns. It is a machine people are afraid of.
For one example of this political machine, Law points to the Economic Opportunity Act, a bill Norcross helped write when he served in the state legislature. It made it easier for companies to get tax breaks by moving to Camden, but Law says it wasted taxpayer money without helping city residents.
Why did zero of it go towards addressing the fact that there isn't a single supermarket in the city? If it's supposed to help residents, that is an area of business that not only would create jobs, but would actually help residents of the city. Why did virtually none of it go towards small business owners that live in Camden City, people that would actually hire folks in Camden City?
Norcross says because of the bill, Subaru, Holtec International, the Philadelphia 76ers, and other companies are making never-before-seen investments in Camden.
When we look back over the last two decades, nothing has been happening in economic development. There was many stops and starts that happened there.
The two Democrats agree on the importance of some issues, like education. Norcross emphasizes K-12 and often discusses the value of apprenticeships, which he opted for instead of a bachelor's degree, while Law wants to reduce college student loan debt. But they also differ on several top priorities. Norcross is big on national security.
Whether it's our neighborhoods to make sure we're safe in any community you lived in, or our nation, which is being challenged every day.
While Law hopes to overhaul the country's campaign finance rules.
You and I might have a disagreement on policy. You might be a Republican, I might be a Democrat, but we cannot have real compromise and real growth in our policy unless we prevent our democracy from being up for sale.
Law also accuses Norcross of voting with Republicans too often, particularly on high-profile issues such as the Keystone XL pipeline, which Norcross supported, and the Iran nuclear deal, which he opposed. But Norcross doesn't see it that way.
I don't vote Democrat. I don't vote Republican. I vote for what is right for the district, and that's what they sent me there to do. I did not get sent there to just blindly follow one party or the other. If it's a good deal for my district and it works for our country, that's what I'm going to do.
Law faces a steep uphill climb in the June 7th primary. Norcross is the incumbent and has endorsements from the Democratic State Committee and groups like the Sierra Club and the State Teachers Union. He's also outraising his opponent 20-1. But that hasn't slowed down Law. The tech consultant built a computer program to target likely voters. He's railed against Norcross on popular websites like the Huffington Post and Reddit. And he says his campaign is stronger because he's ignored all the time-honored political advice he's gotten.
Oh, you need to spend all your time fundraising, you know, talk to rich people, get them to give you money. If you ask rich people's permission to run, that's the only way to do it. And it's like, well, no.
You really never want to bet against an incumbent.
Ross Baker is a political science professor at Rutgers University and an expert on Congress. He says Norcross's name recognition, for better or worse, is an asset. Baker also says Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have made this an unpredictable year, so the insurgent candidate might have more of a chance.
It may be one of those kind of lightning strikes opportunities for an insurgent like Alex Law to come in and knock off a big name and certainly make a statement about the viability of insurgent candidates in a state that generally doesn't support them.
A Republican hasn't represented the first district since the 1970s, so the primary winner is expected to prevail in November. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
The first ever Chinese Lantern Festival in the Northeast United States continues at Philadelphia's Franklin Square into next month. In an earlier iteration, Franklin Square, a.k.a. Bum Park, was the only place Chinatown children could play. Visitors, though, need merely walk a couple of blocks to be in one of the nation's most vibrant and evolving Chinatowns. Let's take it up with Catherine Wilson, author of Ethnic Renewal in Philadelphia's Chinatown, Space, Place, and Struggle. Kate, welcome to Newsworks tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
We learn about commonalities with other Chinatowns across the country, but in many ways, Philadelphia's is unique. But it did start with this wave in the 19th century of immigrants coming to the United States, first on the West Coast.
Most of the Chinatowns in other parts of the country were all the result of Chinese immigrants being pushed out of the West. So they dispersed across the country, and that's when a lot of these other Chinatowns got formed, including Philadelphia's.
Pushed out of the West, but also pushed down by laws against, for example, bringing families over from
yes.
Chinatown. So it was largely populated in many cities by bachelors.
Most of them had families back in China, but they weren't allowed to bring their wives to the United States. And most of them were merchants. And again, this was also a product of U.S. law. You couldn't have immigration back and forth unless you were a merchant. So a lot of them banded together in these merchant co-ops, guilds, and formed businesses. In terms of Philadelphia's Chinatown, there's a core of families that have been there since the early 20th century. And then around about the 1940s, when Holy Redeemer Church was built, there was a small cluster of families. And then that began to slowly grow and then really exploded in the post-war period.
And that core is what I presume you mean by the notion of place. But the space has been forever shrinking and threatened by planning commissions, well-intentioned notions of, for example, the Vine Street Expressway.
Just when Chinatown is starting to grow, right, and become even more of a community is when it starts to be threatened by the outside because of various urban renewal. And you have to understand that at this time, city planners thought the way to revitalize cities was to build all this spectacle downtown. Like, let's bring people in and through the city.
Convention right? Center.
Convention Center, Independence Mall, Gallery, all of these kinds of things would bring people in. And then we build highways to get them through the city efficiently. Right. Not thinking about what was already there.
When did advocates and activism really launch in terms of trying to maintain and grow the existing Chinatown?
Well, it really begins in 1966 when residents learn about the plans for the Vine Street Expressway. There was plans to demolish Holy Redeemer Chinese Catholic Church and School to make room for exit and entrance ramps onto the expressway. Initially, it was Holy Redeemer moms who said, we need to fight this because we can't lose this church and school. It was the only playground, it was the only gymnasium, it was the only school, and it was really part of what made it a real community for people.
And because of, in part, a lack of space, it's much less prevalent that an Asian coming to our Philadelphia region would even situate in Chinatown.
Part of that is because there's not enough affordable housing in Chinatown. And so Chinatown kind of becomes this symbolic center and a place of origin, right? Because this is where the community started. So there is this kind of sense of even if people aren't settling directly in Chinatown, Chinatown is still the heart, the cultural heart and the symbolic heart of the community. And there are still reasons to come to Chinatown.
So even the most ardent activists and supporters of Chinatown don't want to preserve it as some sort of a Disney World, as it were. They recognize that it's always evolving.
It is not just a tourist destination. It is not just a collection of restaurants. It's a place where elders live, where children grow up and go to school. They want very much to retain that sense of living community. And there has been this funny dynamic in Chinatown between the outside that people who visit Chinatown see, right, which is the whole all the Chinesey stuff, and the inside world of Chinatown that people grow up in and live. And when I interviewed people for this project, I found that the things that they remembered, the places that they remembered, were this kind of backstage, right, the alleyways, the church gymnasium. These were where they had memories, or they had memories of struggle and activism, of protest. And neither one of these things lend themselves to that tourist attraction. But that's what makes Chinatown Chinatown. And that's what places, memory, home, neighbor, family. And that's what the Chinatown activists struggle to preserve.
Catherine, thanks so much for joining us
on
Newsworks Tonight. Catherine Wilson, author of Ethnic Renewal in Philadelphia's Chinatown. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.